Richard Dolan, our special guest tonight. Lots to talk with him about. What's going on up there when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Richard Dolan. So, Richard, this case that I stumbled up. I always knew about Frank Stranges when I was a kid. I would read his books. A fascinating guy. But so I'm in Laughlin, Nevada. I'm at this event, and Craig Campobasso is there, and he's showing a film called Stranger at the Pentagon.
Right.
And it's a short film, and he's won an award for it from the Burbank Film Festival. But it was provocative. The story was unbelievable. It's based on Frank Stranges meeting this Venusian named Valiant Thor, who landed here and spoke with Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon when he was the vice president, and stayed a couple years, and then he left. Weird.
Yeah, he left, I think, back in around 1960. I don't really know how to take this story, George. I will tell you that years ago, long before I did UFO research, I was friends here in Rochester when I was still doing graduate work at the University of Rochester with, I believe it was a niece of Frank Stranges, who was living in Rochester with her husband, and she was taking a class that I was I think I was assistant teacher for, and I just became friendly. And she said, yeah, and my uncle is this guy, and she showed me his business card. It was Frank Stranges. And it seemed so strange to me at the time. I didn't take it seriously. And then years later, I became familiar with his story. But actually, yeah, what he claims is that there is a Thor who, the normal-sized human, but lived like hundreds of years long. He had an extra digit on each hand. I think he had six fingers on each hand. And other key differences, and could speak like every single language fluently, apparently. I just don't know what to make of the story. I mean, I have no idea. I would love to get back in touch with this lady who knew him and really interview her. I don't even know if I could find her.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an incredible case.
Our world. These stories make no sense, but then they just keep coming at us over and over again, you know?
And there's enough behind these stories to really be convincing.
Often that is the case, yeah.
I mean,
in this instance, I don't really, I'm not comfortable saying one way or the other. And I really have been making a note to myself to see this film, and I haven't seen it, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, let's talk about some other issues here that that you've been working on. You've talked about that it's harder and harder to determine if a UFO is made here on good old planet Earth by humans or that it might be of extraterrestrial origin.
Yes.
Why is it so difficult these days?
Well, I mean, we, if it were 1950 and we were to have a report of an object flying at an altitude of 100,000 feet at multiple thousands of miles per hour,
It's not ours.
That's
not,
right.
Not them.
In fact, this was written about in Bruce Maccabee's excellent book that I published a little earlier called The FBI-CIA UFO Connection. And Bruce nails it, and he makes this crystal clear that this was being tracked at that time back then in 1950-51 in what was known as Project Twinkle, and people can look this up in his book. So that's one thing. That's 1950, and we know there's no evidence that we had anything that could go at that altitude, 100,000 feet, absolutely no way, thousands of miles per hour, ditto. Today is a different story. We've got highly advanced drones. Now, there's this new story that's going on in France, which I know you've been following this, which is about these so-called drones that have been flying over French nuclear plants. And the last that I've checked, about almost two dozen of these, or excuse me, not two dozen, but like about 14, 15 of these, I think, have been noted, where these objects are hanging around French nuclear facilities. They are very sophisticated. And in fact, that one of the more recent stories that I read just indicated that the French put army helicopters, which try to intercept these things, very advanced and efficient high-speed helicopters, and they failed. They tried to follow the drones.
That's amazing.
But they lost them. And then you have other accounts of these drones. They sound exactly like UFOs. They are, they've got like lights, triangular lights, patterns that described on them. Sometimes beams of lights coming down. I mean, all of this sounds very, very familiar to UFO researchers. Now, the media is describing these as drones, and you might just say, well, you know, maybe they're not drones. Maybe they're genuine UFOs. That could be the case. After all, there's a long history, very long history, of these objects being interested in hanging around in the vicinity of our nuclear facilities worldwide. Yes, all of that. However, it is also true that drone technology, especially the unofficial classified drones, more and more that we're starting to learn about these things are highly advanced. And, you know, I'll just tell you, and one of my witnesses, someone that I spoke to at great length, as a matter of fact, you know, described a drone sighting from 2003 that in New Mexico, that she was absolutely convinced, for a number of reasons, that this was one of ours. It was a spherical object, maybe 3 to 4 feet in diameter at nighttime, metallic, not perfectly smooth. It looked, she said, it was like a small version of the Death Star. And it was only 100 to 200 feet above her and her companion, who were in a hot tub having a nice evening in New Mexico. No noise, totally silent. Her opinion is that it was definitely one of ours, not an alien craft. I said, well, why do you say that? She said, I can't tell you exactly why, except that we were staying at the place at a ranch of a guy who was a high-level scientist, military contractor, who, when we mentioned this, gave this knowing look. This is back in 2003. I've since learned, and in trying to understand the nature of drone technology and how advanced, that they are so, so advanced in terms of being able to make these objects that, you know, look like perfect triangular craft nowadays.
Right.
We didn't really have this capability a few years ago. So the line is getting very blurry. And by the way, that one individual, that woman, had an experience much earlier in her life as a teenager in the 1980s, where in her bedroom, she was just reading alone in her bedroom, and she looked up, and this object was a small roundish object was hovering in her bedroom. And I mean, it shocked her, of course. And she's just staring at it. She didn't see any motion. She didn't see it enter the room. This is in upstate New York at the time. It was about 1 foot across in diameter. It was spherical, metallic. There was a light on the front. Same type of light, she said, that was on this other object 20 years later that she saw. About the size of a basketball, hovering 10 feet away from her. She freaks out. She's thinking, what the heck is this? Her mother walks into the room, also sees it, and flips out. Now, the mom had not believed her daughter all these years that the daughter was having all of these strange experiences, on and on and on. Anyway, this object went toward the window, which was closed, and it went through the window without breaking it. Mom was hysterical, crying. What was that? So I had a long conversation with this woman about this. And this is another stand-up individual, by the way, a very honest person.
No reason to doubt them.
No, right? Absolutely none. Her assessment is that that smaller object in her bedroom was probably a non-human, an alien device. That's her opinion. But that the later object is one of our attempts to copy what they have. I don't see that as illogical at all. I see that as entirely possible. But my point is that simply in an era of modern drones, you know, we have drones now that have lasers mounted to them to shoot down missiles. We have drones that can go at thousands of miles per hour, officially speaking. We have drones that have what are called sense and avoid systems on board to enable them to not collide with other aircraft in the sky. They're becoming incredibly sophisticated. And on top of that, you know, aside from the video effects that people can create to create hoaxes, in the cases of legitimate sightings that are out there. There's one that I just saw from earlier this month in November of a UFO or apparent UFO over a Mexican nuclear facility. And this is a very interesting video, and I don't think this is fake. But the question is, what is it?
And they shut them down, don't they, for a while?
Yeah, there have been cases, a number of cases, where nuclear facilities, nuclear technology have been disabled, have been shut down. Absolutely, yes. And we only know about a few of these, because I really think most remain secret, George. I think of, like, if you know, when you think of the amount of UFO activity that's out there every single day, every day. In North America alone, the two main websites that collect reports, the National UFO Reporting Center and the MUFON database, they combine for well over 10,000 sightings a year. Well over 10,000 sightings a year, just in North America alone. And so I'm not saying those are all alien craft, obviously, but some of these are real head-scratchers, very difficult. So if you pretend that, like, there's this wall and every UFO sighting is a white dot, well, you know, after a little while, that wall would be completely white. But then here comes secrecy with buckets of black paint, and they tossed buckets of black paint on the wall, and all we have left are these little white spots. That's the data that we have to work with. That's what I'm convinced. And in terms of the nuclear UFO connection, I'm convinced all that we get to look at are those little white spots that are not covered up by the black paint, because most of that stuff is covered up. I think that this is a significant thing happening. But again, it's more and more tricky these days, because our own official capabilities are just so advanced. I think, you know, there's this spectrum of officially acknowledged technology, then classified Defense Department technology, and then I suspect that there's technology that's in the black budget world that's even beyond that, in what I call a breakaway civilization, that may not even be under formal DOD control, for all I know. So you've got this spectrum of advanced technology. But even I think what the Pentagon has is, you know, what we're learning. I went to Boeing's website a little earlier, and their unmanned airborne systems, in other words, their drones, they've got a lot of very, very advanced technology that's out there. And it just makes it more and more difficult for a UFO researcher who's trying to differentiate between, you know, what are we making and what might we not be making.
Right.
It's harder and harder and harder.
What do you think of the alien, as Paula Harris says, contact program, as opposed to the abduction program, which is all one and the same to me?
Well, I know Paula, and I assume by that she means...
She thinks they're happening for good purposes.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I'm not so sure.
No, I don't know. I think what's happening is that if I try to be as objective as I can, and this is hard because this is such a confusing subject, but it seems to me that we're dealing with multiple groups. And I only say that because this almost sounds like a cop-out. Well, because it's all of these different experiences people have. But when you really think of the different experiences people have, it does seem like there are multiple types of groups. You have entities that look totally different from each other. They could, in theory, be working together, but are all the humans really working with all the reptilians and all the grays? Are they actually all on one team? It doesn't seem right to me on that basis. And on the other side of it, there's also, you do have people who have what they are adamant about are these very positive contacts, often with human-looking beings. You got the strange friendship case from over in Italy from years and years ago, from individuals who seem very credible, frankly, when you listen to them speak about their encounters with a very, very tall human or very, very short human, who gave them all of this information about their, their civilization. These people don't seem to be lying. Is it possible that there's a contact agenda? I guess I would say the answer is yes, it is certainly possible that there's a contact agenda from some of these creatures. But I, like you, I have a bit of caution before I would really endorse that thesis. On the other hand, I do feel comfortable saying that there is a covert operation going on, that there are beings that do not look human, that look like what we call the grays.
Right.
Short with large heads and black eyes. And this is something that comes through so many times. And this is not simply cultural programming.
And those, of course, were the beans that people from the Roswell era reported.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, I had a conversation with a retired U.S. military officer, high level, who had a long-standing interest in UFOs, who told me point blank of his meeting with in the classified world of a man on his deathbed, who had been at Roswell in 1947, and this officer was able to interview this man, accompanied by military security, who were in the hospital room with him, and he had a conversation with this guy about being there. The man described the being, which was short, not like a classic gray either, but short, definitely not a human being like we are. An interesting aspect of that, I guess I'll just mention, is that the colonel, this guy was a colonel, and he said to the dying man, he says, it's a shame that you can't talk about your incredible experiences. Wouldn't it be nice if there were a presidential executive order that would liberate you from your secrecy oath? And the man said, exact quotes, George, it would take a hell of a lot more than a presidential executive order to liberate me from my security oath.
So true.
And I asked, well, what are we talking about? Something beyond the president? He said, yeah, that's what I would assume. Something beyond the president, something more powerful than the president. Fascinating world. But, you know, in terms of the contact issue, my guess is this, that we humans right now we're at a very fascinating moment in our history. We're at the point where we've reinvented ourselves over the past century, and that we're shooting up like a rocket. You know, we've gone from, you know, think of 100 years ago with the outbreak of the First World War and what our world was like then, and there were still horses everywhere and wooden carts everywhere. And we go from that to where we are now in 100 years. That's nothing. My feeling is that any observing intelligence that is able to observe us, they're here now because this is the big show going on, the transformation of humanity. And my sense is that we're drawing everyone in who's able to be here. That would be the good, the bad, the ugly, the scientists who are here to observe, the interstellar economic hitmen who want to, like, steal and plunder, because I can't see why that wouldn't be the case. You know, the missionaries maybe who want to make us into join the Galactic Federation, if that's what the case is. Who knows? I think that we would be drawing in, at least this is how I look at it, a wide range. And indeed, this is what seems to be the case when you start looking at the reports. You get these wide range. You get these craft that take, like that guy in Ohio. That I'm going to assume that was not a human craft. They came down, they took them for several hours, traumatized them.
Big time.
Said, you're not going to talk about this. And by the way, the follow-up of that was he went to talk to his friends the next day, the next evening, after he got back from work, and they were gone. They moved out. They moved out. Everything was gone. Everything was gone.
Why'd they move out? Or did they?
They never found out. They just took off.
Or did somebody move them out?
Exactly. I mean, I've wondered this myself. He wonders this. No one knows. Was this some black budget operation saying, oh, my God, we can't let these people talk anymore?
Richard, when we come back, I want to ask you about where are we now since the era of the Dr. J. Allen Hynek period. What's next on Coast to Coast AM? Hey, have you had a chance yet to watch our television program Beyond Belief? It is a rapidly growing internet-based show. Simply go to this website and take a look, www.beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Richard Dolan with us. Richard, since the passing of Dr. J. Allen Hynek years ago, have we truly, you know, there aren't many left. I mean, you're out there, Stanton Friedman, Paula Harris, but what's coming along? Who's after you? Is there anybody there?
Well, I asked myself that question, George. I'm now 52 years old. I still feel young. I still feel very good, but I'm not 38, which is what I was when I first became publicly known in the UFO field. I was the young guy at that time. I'd come up with my new book, UFOs in the National Security State. There are some young people out there. I'm just waiting for them to write kinds of definitive or, you know, really powerful books that are going to help move us forward. I'm very fond of young Micah Hanks, who's in his early 30s.
Yeah.
Micah's written some very fine books, kind of philosophical explorations of UFO phenomenon and future of artificial intelligence, and I like his work. But in terms of younger people out there, I don't know. I mean, I'm waiting. You know, I miss the late Mac Tawney, so a lot of people who...
And he died young.
Oh, he sure did. He was in his 30s just maybe 5 years ago. Mac's last book was called The Crypto-Terrestrials. He had some fascinating theories about what we're dealing with. But I don't know. I mean, I wonder, you know, what's happened to ufology as a research discipline? I can't believe that it's dead, because the phenomenon itself is not dead. The phenomenon itself continues to intrigue. It continues to be here. None of it's gone away. I think where I'm seeing a lot of the new research these days is in encounters. And so I think there are a number of people who are, you know, discussing their research, whether it's, you know, hypnotherapists like Yvonne Smith, who talks about her abduction research, Barbara Lamb, who's also, both of them are out on the West Coast dealing with abduction research. But that seems to be what a lot of people are interested in. There are UFO researchers who do the old nuts and bolts research. They don't seem to get themselves out there and get a lot of publicity, but I try to make myself familiar with a lot of what they're doing. But a lot of that stuff is going on very quietly. In terms of UFO research, I would really like to see some younger, smart people get in the game and start making some contributions.
Yeah, that would be good. So I had a story at the top of the show about how scientists have found on the Comet Lander organic material, the basis,
oh God,
the building, yeah, the building blocks of life.
Is this a breaking story?
It was just an exciting story that they released.
Well, it's quite fascinating.
It is?
It's quite fascinating. I mean, you know, this is on a comet, for goodness sake. I think what we have to understand that we here living on this planet, why would we think that this is unique? Yeah, there are still these dumb scientists out here who make these claims that, yes, we are unique. There's no other life in the universe. I just think, where do you get off with such a statement? We're talking, everything that you can see in the night sky is about like this tiny little segment of our galaxy. Let alone other galaxies out there. There's just a limitless supply of stars and planets and probably life. And, you know, if the conditions are right here on Earth for life to evolve, of course, why wouldn't they be right to evolve elsewhere in, you know, myriad places? And look, so no, I think that life is probably the norm for this universe. Don't you think so?
Oh, it's teeming. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, it's a fascinating story. I'm glad you told me.
It's just a matter of how they get here, and it's got to be through a wormhole or some kind of bending of space and time, Richard.
Well, you know, honestly, this is one of the most fascinating things for me now. Like in my, again, I'm promoting myself here shamelessly, but in my last book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, which, if I may mention, is on my website at richarddolanpress.com, my favorite chapter of that book, of writing that book, was my chapter on the science of the UFOs, because what we find is that all of the sciences that seemed to make UFOs impossible back in the 1950s and 60s have turned out to be entirely possible and totally comprehensible. Like, for example, space travel, you know, what you're talking about. Back in the 1950s and 60s, it was the norm for scientists to say, it's impossible for us to make it to another star, let alone another planet, but certainly another star, never going to happen. No one could get there. You people don't understand how far the stars are from each other. And, you know, we hear this. But guess what? There are all kinds of valid scientific mathematical constructs which do allow for interstellar travel. And famously, a mathematician at the University of Wales 20 years ago, Miguel Alcubierre, came up with a series of formulas that are legitimate, they are sound, and they allow for, well, essentially a Star Trek warp drive propulsion type of system whereby mm-hmm. space and time are bent. Now, what we don't have, according to Alcubierre's theories, is a sufficient amount of energy yet to do that bending of space-time that would allow you to travel like through this bubble that would be faster than the speed of light, effectively. But, hey, you know, so we don't have the amount of energy, but the math is sound. So what if we got that amount of energy? Then we could do it.
When do you think we'll...
Someone else is a little bit ahead of us.
When do you think we'll discover this? Truly discover? 20 years from now? 50? 100?
Right now, everything is coming together. Computing power is driving this because it's allowing all these other developments to be made. We're talking about radically advanced artificial intelligence. That's going to be key. We're talking about radically advanced nanotechnology, also going to be important in terms of material science and allowing us to construct, you know, optimal materials for space travel, let's say. All right, you can do that with nanotech. And then think about something as crazy as quantum computing, excuse me, which I can't even wrap my brain around half the time, but this is said to going to be as radical to our current computing is to, say, the Gutenberg printing press. So we're reinventing everything right now, right now. I would give it, I mean, within 20 years, we could easily be in a completely different world, so far different than what we are today. It would even be greater than our difference from 1994, 20 years ago. I think we're moving into a radical future. Whether it's going to be a good future or not is another question. But in terms of the technology, in terms of our capabilities. Hey, I just was coming across an article just the last day or two about a salt water-powered car that got approval in Europe. It's real.
Amazing. Yeah, I knew they were working on something like that.
It works like a hydrogen fuel cell, pardon me, except that the liquid used for storing the energy is salt water. I mean, this is just an amazing thing. The salt water passes through a membrane there in between these two tanks. It creates an electric charge. Electricity is stored and then distributed by supercapacitors. And the car carries the water in these big tanks. I'm looking at a picture of the car. It's pretty cool looking, very futuristic, like out of iRobot or something like that. But this is a real thing, and it's been approved. So, we're right on the edge of moving into some radical changes in how we function as a civilization.
It's exciting.
It's exciting. It's everything. It's exciting. It's, you know, and then you look at the other side of it, which, you know, I've always been a political animal. I've always looked at the political implications of UFOs and the political implications of everything. And I won't lie. I mean, I'm concerned about, you know, where we're going as a civilization in terms of surveillance, in terms of intimidation, in terms of globalization and the creation of transnational legal systems that make national laws more and more irrelevant. So we got that side of it. But then we got this magical technology. And how all of this is going to play out in the next generation or so, this is just an incredible, fascinating, sometimes disturbing story, but hey, we're here, we're living it, we're going to get to participate in it, and hopefully let's do a good job and make this world a better place.
What is your favorite UFO story of all times?
My favorite UFO story?
Yeah, Roswell, the Lonnie Zamora case, which one?
Well, that's a good one. I don't know, George, maybe you stumped me. I remember one time, I don't know if you remember this, but we were chatting, and you asked me what was my what I thought was the best UFO case. And I remember thinking, I like the 1976 Iranian intercept case, because that's a good one, because it's got good documentation.
Yeah.
That's a strong case, and it's fascinating on its own merits. But my favorite case, well,
I like the Lonnie Zamora, the police officer. He's not with us anymore. Socorro, New Mexico case.
That is an interesting case for a lot of reasons. And I guess I don't think of UFO cases in terms of, like, what's my favorite. Maybe I should loosen up a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think that's a fascinating case because that's 1964. You've got a New Mexico police officer. Everyone likes this guy. Everyone who knew Lonnie Zamora said he's an honest, good guy. He's in the middle of pulling over a speeder on the New Mexico highway, and this thing zooms over perpendicular to him and goes down. He pulls off. He breaks off the chase. He drives up, gets out of his car, walks up this hill, and sees a landed craft, and he sees what looked like, he thought it was a car at first, with two children outside. And as he walks closer to it, he thinks, wait a minute, these are not children, and they're like these little creatures. And wait a minute, that's not a car, that's a craft. And he panics. He got really scared. And his instinct was to run away. But then he thinks better of it. But by the time he gets back, this craft is lifting off silently, by the way, and it zips off. And that case is fascinating for many reasons, because it left a landing trace, which was examined by a lot of law enforcement and private UFO organizations. Everyone came to investigate that case. Lonnie Zamora was interrogated, interviewed for hours by FBI, by police, by local law, by local UFO researchers. Everyone said he was legit. It's an amazing case.
Now, what's interesting, is it possible that what he witnessed, because it happened a little before the moon landing, 5 years before, that what he saw was like the Eagle lander and a couple would-be astronauts, and they were testing this thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's not hard to go there because of that whole context and because the way that this craft was described, it was kind of lander-like. But the problem with that is when you look at the chronology of the construction of the lander, I don't think there was any way that the thing was ready, even for testing in 1964. That seems to me way, way, way
really
early for me.
Huh.
That's my take on it. That's my take on it. Maybe I should revisit that. But also, I mean, there's no record of anything like this. There's just, you know, when you talk to NASA, you come up empty with that. There's just no there's no historical evidence for that. So and there's no one in NASA. There's been no leaks to this extent that says, oh yeah, in fact, that was one of our own. I mean, every time people look in that direction, they just come up with a dead end. So I'm not inclined to think so. And in particular, when you get into Lonnie Zamora's description of the beings themselves, they're way too small. These are like children's size. So I'm not inclined to think it was an Apollo-related event. But, you know, this is one of these things that we're just never necessarily going to know the answer to it. It's one of the unsatisfying aspects of this is that there's not a lot of closure on a lot of these events, unfortunately.
Well, that's true. That is true. Where do we go next, Richard, in this entire field? I mean, what happens? I mean, look how many years you've been at it. Look how many years I've been broadcasting it.
Yeah.
We still don't have that answer yet, do we?
No, we don't. And, you know, the old UFO skeptic, Philip J. Klass, used to talk about the UFO curse, I think is what he called it. And for Klass, and he was an arch skeptic.
He was. God rest his soul. You know, he's out on the other side now.
That's right. And he always said, here's the curse for you UFO believers, that when you die, you won't be any more knowledgeable about this phenomenon than you are today. You won't get any new answers. And I think that that's really looking at this the wrong way for two reasons. One is I do think that we actually have learned a lot that we didn't know in decades and years past. I mean, you know, you're talking about the days of J. Allen Hynek. Well, here's something that we know much more than we knew back in the 70s. We have a very good handle, I think, on the fact that there's a real cover-up going on. This was not something that was really evident back then in the 70s. We have a much better idea of phenomenon like abductions than we did back then. Much better. We have a much better idea about how it would be possible to have interstellar flight and to do a lot of the things scientifically, like even like telepathy, and than researchers back then had. So I think we have actually made strides. We have learned new things. But the other thing that Klass got wrong here, and I just think he had the wrong attitude, it's not necessarily the matter of getting every single answer. Because I think that what we're dealing with is a phenomenon that is like, it's like we're fish in the water, and there's this phenomenon that sometimes comes into the water but then goes out, back out onto land. And we little fish, we don't know what it's like even to imagine life on land. We don't even know that land exists. We humans are dealing with a reality that's coming in just beyond that fence that borders our reality. And we struggle to understand it. We may never truly understand it, but that does not mean that we don't benefit from trying. In other words, the journey is the answer. I mean, by making that journey, we're doing something good for ourselves, and we may not get every answer, but we're engaging in what is truly the greatest mystery of our time. And that's worthwhile. That's a worthy endeavor. That's where I think Klass really missed the boat when he talked about this UFO curse. He was looking at it in too short-sighted a way. This is a grand mystery. We're never going to get it all, probably. But in striving, we're going to achieve much, much more than we could ever have imagined if we didn't try.
Other nations still getting lots of UFO reports, Richard?
Yes, they are. I mean, these sightings, the only problem that we have, though, like, it's evident that this phenomenon is worldwide. The problem is reporting mechanisms in other nations and other parts of the world are really lacking. You know, you have some places where, like, various parts in South America, Brazil, in Argentina, some in Chile, there are places where if you had a UFO sighting, you might have private groups or even law enforcement to report it to, and it might be collected. But there's not a systematic collection database that really has like all of the numbers. Japan, ditto. I mean, there's UFO research in Japan, but it's not systematic. It's bad enough in the United States and Canada, but we have a system that's actually much better than anywhere else in terms of collecting this stuff. Russia, same thing. China, same thing. So it's a global phenomenon. But really what we have is a tremendous lacking of people around the world organizing to document this, to create their own organizations. I mean, when we were talking earlier about the future of ufology, my goodness gracious, there's an entire world out there of people. And where are the researchers in India? Where are the researchers in Central Africa? I mean, this phenomenon is going on everywhere.
Well, it sure is.
I almost feel like we're outmatched, you know, as a civilization, but we don't have to be. We're in an era where we can communicate globally, and we have the ability to create a global UFO database and network, and I don't rule that out. I'd like to see that happen.
Richard, when we come back in just a few moments, we're going to take some phone calls with you in our final hour here on Coast to Coast AM.